thank you very much indeed for that introduction and for your hospitality here in Cork. See if I can just get this worked out. Okay, is that all right? Is that working like that? Sorry, thank you. Okay. I'll read a couple of pieces from earlier books, a couple of things from a recent collection, and I'll finish with a few unpublished poems, approximately in that order. This is a short piece from a longish poem I published in The Mouth of a River in 2007. And the central narrative poem in that collection was about rivers, and particularly about rivers in Mayo and the migration of salmon during the summer. But there are a few other things being woven into the story as well at this point. So this is just one brief section from the longer piece. It was the same sea reshuffling the shore at the windward edge of the sandy cemetery, and the same ground where his bones used to rest, until one January storm finally made a break in the wall, and the council knew that history had a formidable enemy. On winter tides, a seal would appear out of the surf to check the progress of skulls and other bones falling from the bank, until the head itself was threatened that had sung it all one time. And then it happened, that dull, unavoidable commotion of the damned ocean, pounding at the base of those small grains of comfort he had come to love, saying, "This is the time now to release yourself back to those waves where all life began." And the skull fell into the foam and floated where flounder and bass ran in the shallows. When another wave came and it smashed, it could have settled into the small mercy of sand. But a fish had been alerted, and that was enough. The next piece I'll read is in three sections, three shortish sections, and it's called it's called The Declensions. You know, sometimes people ask you about poems, where does poetry come from, what inspires you, and sometimes it's as if there's an expectation that poetry should come from some very strong emotional moment, some very intense reaction to a personal event or a public event. But sometimes poetry actually can come from something more abstract, from an idea, from a let's have a go at this just for the sake of it. And sometimes that can work. Sometimes you can rub two sticks together on a cold day and make something of an occasion. It doesn't have really much to it to begin with. And as I was sort of rubbing the sticks together, I was thinking of the idea in grammar that sometimes you have nouns that are masculine, feminine, and in some languages neuter. So I tried to write something about the masculine, the feminine, and the neuter. And the category started to break down in the third section. But anyway, there was enough there as a result. Declensions. A man straddles the 3D watery space between a hard pier and a shifting thwart as he stows cases for transport. And he stows the thole pins, the oars, the solid gunnels, the laths, the elver trail of stitching on the sail's hem in the tarred hull of the vessel sustaining them. Like a curragh being hauled by craftsmen over a rough sea, language sinks into a trough and peaks again miraculously, a tiny black boat diminishing on the wide sea of story with words for weather, for seaweed, for stonechat, for flotsam. While the men are away, a woman walks to the end of her house with dregs and a zinc basin. She launches a ragged line of spray into space. Before it vanishes in the grass, she imagines the flexing cast of her husband's seed in their early years. Her diviner's arms relax. For an instant, she holds a wide ring in her lap, like Sheila Nagig grasping the lids of the eye of the storm, where seas pile up and seasoned men are overwhelmed as they ride the waters for a word they wanted from her. A local surfer rides ashore on the churning rim of a wave and steps down into the foam to hoist his gliding board under his arm. There's that dizzy space as the water slides back between his toes, and the whole island takes some time to compose itself. A deserted stretch of beach with its marram hairpiece, a slaty sky, and a sharp bouquet of sea holly. Here's our suited rider with his stride thrashing through the dry sand and his bright board with its fin, as Ariane survives the drowning sea and carries home the dolphin. Thanks. In one of my collections, in the in Mouth of a River, there's a section of poems on the Spencer story, and of course you know the story of the Sweeney story, the story of Sweeney being changed into a bird, wandering around Ireland in that wild state for years. And I have a series of poems there where Sweeney has different transformations as different species of bird. So I give it a kind of a natural history slant. And this is one from that sequence. It's called One for Sorrow. At the prime time of May blossom, something grey shoots past at dusk, hunched under the gloom, impaired my memory. Fated to survive, it lords the lanes and callows, folded in its robes on a post, nowhere earning victimhood. With the big house burnt and the gamekeeper gone, no one is left to nail it to its throne and let it haunt like a god. Sorrow, to be sure, in the elaborate care of its preenings. Without these, it would not go far through the galaxies of flies. Once, badly shaken by a catapult, it hove its kite out of parkland and spent a night as the eye of river alders. Ever since, winged on its fear, it glides down a margin of terror to the end of a life. No leisure to ask how one can live like this, no conscience to decode its screeching chatter, whatever it is, breaching the peace of the ruined domains. I'll read a few things from the 2014 collection, Carnival Masks. And some of these poems then take us to Mayo, where my wife and I have lived since 1994. And after all your careful planning, you can't find the poem you had marked earlier. See, we got there. Okay. The other book. Sorry, this one is, it's a poem set in Mayo, in North Mayo, where I go fairly regularly walking and fishing. It's in the Barony of Erris. It's a very wide, to some eyes, very bleak, empty landscape. But as you explore it, you discover things that detain you. And this is a reference, at one level, to a little falcon that occurs there, the Merlin. Merlin and Tarsicon Moor. This is where the wizard lives, still being realized to cleave a range over the heatherings of a morning, a surprise out of the mist. This is where the horizon keeps an old, nimble jack away from the chattering city, so no one can repute him to a bad end, and no industry can exile him any farther. He needs nothing more than the posts he nominates with his feet, this wire, this riverbank, this facing of stone to accommodate his desert eye. And these two foxholes on the far side, the stops of a flute he plays when he lifts the glittering river. But could you find him if you looked? There has to be another god to upstage, a different day that starts with maps. And just as you stop for a Eucharist of sandwiches, suddenly Pipit, the Redeemer, is gone. And there he is with the mountain on his shoulders. He's carrying the valley's only song. As I began to explore that part of North Mayo, sort of early on in my time in Mayo, I met an old man called Penny MacHugh, who still followed cattle up and down a river there, went across the bog and saw where the cattle had gone to overnight. And he told me quite soberly, quite matter-of-factly, that a giant used to live on the top of the mountain where there's a big cairn called Dáithí Bán's cairn. So I'll read this poem in memory of Paddy MacHugh. The Drover's Stick. Following on from your stories, how you drove your cattle through the night roads to the fair, you brought out your stick collection and gifted me what I asked for, the one I have to keep, a hazel newly cut from the roadside in Nathan's shadow. Its white eyes peep where someone claimed the stems. If I never make your miles along your moorland river, this drover's stick will remember another pace as it seasons in the corner within the busy house. I take its weight again and test its swing in the air, like the wand you waved at dawn when you conjured your given way and drove those thirsting shoulders on towards the lightning horizon. I had an interest in, still have an interest in the work of Edmund Spenser, who of course, as you know, had an estate in North Cork during the Munster Plantation. And I write, there's a few sonnets in Carnival Masks addressed to a Tudor poet, and you know, it doesn't take long to figure out who that Tudor poet is. I read two, there are a series of sonnets. I read just two from the sequence. And one, the first one, is a reference to Spenser's marriage to Elizabeth Boyle in 1594. And on that occasion, he wrote a wedding poem called Epithalamion. And if, you know, if there's one poem by Spenser's that still makes it into the anthologies, it would be Epithalamion. And it marks a particularly happy moment in his life. The walled town of Cork, 1594. Your son has dreamed midsummer. The screech owl has been quelled. The marriage bed is decked with little cupids sporting round the posts, and an amber moon rising into space has confirmed you both at your happiest. Just then, two men stood in the street below watching your lattice, and a feeble glow wavering before you blew the taper out. One had eaten his fill at your table. The other was going to watch at the gate. How did it go for Lady Elizabeth and Master Edmund? The wedding went well, but everything they have is so fragile. And at a certain point, I made my way to Kilcolman to look at the castle. And what I didn't realise was that the landowner there is really quite particular about who he allows onto the land to view the ruin. But I didn't know that at the time, so I just went in and looked around. There are no signs for the last miles to your monument in Ireland. I had to ask for Spenser's castle and found they knew your name, and so allowed my trespass over two fields of deep, tedded hay. The light of August was ebbing around your ruin of time. A mob of swallows chased a sparrowhawk that had just left the cliff of your old house. I squeezed in through a broken gate and climbed your winding stair to an emptiness, an epic imagined where predators now came to pluck their kill. Going down, I raised another ghost, a kester from an arch, and heard it calling over lonely flats at the Obeg's margin. We're into a very, very beautiful, perhaps the most beautiful time of year, the month of May, and we're just approaching the time when the May blossom comes out and just is like a blizzard of snow heavy on the hedges. And last year, you may remember that the May was a particularly beautiful month, and the weather actually settled on the 2nd of May, and was glorious for the rest of the month. And I found that I was writing quite a few poems then, and I was thinking of an aunt of mine who had a small farm in West Limerick. Her name was May, Auntie May, we called her. And she farmed, small holding, and I would go there in the summer from Limerick. And I suppose if I have a connection to the countryside, some of it was really forged spending time at my aunt's house. So this is May. A maiden aunt who approached those dazzling heaps of white as she crossed a field to the well, keeping a track clear for her nephew who would come in June when the blossom was over. I fished obsessively in the river and made her anxious. She believed that the big pool by the bridge had swallowed a coach and four. Now I'm on her track once more, waist deep in rushes, to fill her white enamel bucket and get it brimming back to the scullery cold. Loose boots across a concrete yard, white spit of my toothpaste on silverweed, confusing the hens, a zinc mug dipped to rinse my mouth and fill again with May blossom until the month runneth over. And this is set in the same place. Swallows. Traffic of swallows over the cow dung in May's yard. The low, dark arrows turned up every summer to a nest in the timbers of the byre where they gossiped high in the gossamer. There was a gap at the door where they got in, which I blocked against their orbiting. Then I swung an empty canvas sack until I brought one down. My hands had more than I could grasp, fins of a wind worker gathered at the shoulder, eye gleam in ochre, their seeds of knowing overcome by me. The air was oppressive in that outhouse, so I went out to the light and set the wings free. And just another poem from that moment, that May moment last year. New leaf. So much fun with pronouns, but in the end, no certainty that any fit. And what if living stopped in the house of optatives? What legacy would be left beyond the obvious material effects? Royal mugs, a green vase of my mother's, dad's flower books. Every day now I visit my own wood to see how wildness structures space with light and leaves, and learn at last to speak the language of the arbitrary and keep saying it before a visitor, out of respect, steps through the back door to smoke a cigarette. If we're still comfortable with time?
Yeah, you're okay.
Okay, I'll... recently we lost John Montague, and I spent a year in Cork as a student, and I met John Montague, who at the time had just received the prize of the Irish American Cultural Institute for poetry, and I was just a young lad, 17 or 18 at the time. I was very unsure of myself, but there was just that sense that you were visiting a celebrity. And I suppose there was that early feeling of, oh, the first time I'd been, I suppose, within that light briefly. Some years, well, many years later then, Jessica and I went to Nice and met John and Elizabeth. We just hailed them in the street, we saw them and introduced ourselves, and we got to know them then. And I'll read this for Elizabeth and the late John Montague. The Bay of Angels. After the first, a second life stares out here across the Bay of Angels under the sun's blue eyes. The blue waters come ashore all day to offer themselves endlessly in every wave that rises. Every mane of glass curls before it falls to a final gesture, a rush of foam falling back with a sigh from its metronome. The elemental line was founded here by the haunted practitioners of art. They drove these dusty roads in the 20s, where the strict courtesy of a plaque remembers life as a brilliant gesture. One time we were happy with this remark, but now we want to follow down the pool tiling of white steps and enter the pool. There are few signs of whatever we have been, a crumpled bathrobe on a ledge, a pair of sandals left at the edge of a scene, clues put in discreetly by the painter, with some pathos in the way they were worn to indicate the life of the bather, our only weakness like Achilles at the heel, a mark in leather to prove that this is real. This coast has its proper tone of feeling. It has mastered every interference known, gone through whatever grief or rage could bring to reach this space with a horizon. Other stages are spread for suffering, but a mute decorum rules this one. All it expects of us is that we pay for time to keep disturbance away. A tumbling coast with orange and lemon trees and ancient olives is offered on this basis that we have lived enough with pieties, or at least muddled through in other places, to come here with a harvest of leaves to look over, admiring the traces of a path to an archway, a garden, a door, and the one room we spent years working for.
Thank you very much, Sean.